He also has a ton of books about Duterte, about the South China Sea, and as I said, he has the number one political podcast in the Philippines. And he's periodically here in the United States because he is giving talks and talking to policy people. We're very pleased that we're talking for around 15 minutes. And then we're going to put him in conversation with Professor Vinny Agarwal, who is the distinguished professor and Alan P. Bedford Endowed Chair of Political Science. And he's also the director of our APEC Studies Center here at Berkeley. And I thought it would be a very interesting conversation for Richard and Vinny to meet today. So without further ado, Richard, please.
Ball rolling. Thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm just going to go through this, right? Okay. Fantastic. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. I think this is my first public talk on this side of the continent. Usually I'm on the other side. As you can see, I'm not dressed properly for the fashion culture here. But I'm glad that we're here in a much more corporate setup, so I don't feel so much out of place. As you can see there in the slide, just each of those words are entire lectures or seminars in themselves. I can talk about the Marcoses for a whole semester. I'm working already on a book. From senior to junior, how did we get there? Obviously, the Philippines is a huge, huge conversation, not to mention, of course, the American and the great power rivalry in Asia. Now, I want to leave more room for discussion later on because we want to make it more like a seminar discussion. But so some of the slides there are just for reference points when we're going to hopefully get questions that are more directly related to the points of contention here. Now, obviously, to make sure that we have certain sort of coherence to our discussion, slightly let's go into the conceptual or theoretical framework. First of all, I know there's a lot of ideological discussions out there. There are a lot of pundits with their hot takes out there. I do my own share of that. But the reality is that when you look at geopolitics, especially in Asia, it's very dialectical, meaning it's mutually constitutive. You cannot explain the foreign policy of country X by just saying, oh, this is the mindset of the leader, this is what the leader wants, or the leader was bought off, or the leader is the lackey of this country or that country. It's always a dialectical process. But the reality is that it's also very asymmetrical. So, of course, we tend to criticize America as the global empire, but let's not forget in Asia, China is the really outsized power there, and its relationship with much of the region is asymmetrical. Therefore, when I approach understanding geopolitics of that part of the world, if we have the term of bounded rationality, I look at the term bounded agency, right? So one of the most cliche proverbs you tend to hear in security conferences in Asia is, I think this actually came from Nyerere and folks in Tanzania, but the Singaporeans for some reason keep on quoting that, starting with Lee Kuan Yew, right? Which is, you know, when two elephants are there, if they make love, the grass suffers. If they make war, the grass suffers. And I always had a problem with that kind of metaphor because it tends to reduce much of the world to the grass, right? So I said actually a more appropriate way of looking at geopolitics in Asia and the Pacific region is it's more like a savanna, right? You have the two big elephants, but you have other kinds of predators and robust animals. You have the hyenas and giraffes and all. And that's essentially the interaction that we have in that part of the world. But nevertheless, obviously, some countries and powers have more agency than others. But I think the problem in a lot of discourse out there is, you know, most countries in the region are seen as just a pawns on the chessboard. You know, what is the US doing? What is China doing? Who are they manipulating? Who's a Robin to the Batman of America, right? Because as we discussed now, there is a trilateral summit happening in Washington, D.C. among the Philippines, Japan, and the United States. Now, the other thing that keeps on coming up in discussions about Asia is this idea of we don't want to choose or don't force us to choose between the two superpowers. Again, you keep on hearing this from Singapore, from a lot of Southeast Asian countries, also in other regions of the world, like Central Asia, for instance, you also tend to hear that, Latin America. But for me, not making a choice is a choice itself. And it's a choice that comes with its own risks and liabilities and opportunities. So I think the best way of understanding how a lot of countries in the region approach their great power foreign policy is 50 shades of hedging, right? So everyone is hedging, but some are leaning more to one side than the other. And it's a dynamic hedging. Right? It depends on the circumstances on the ground. But I think as we speak right now, there is a growing concern that some countries, especially frontline countries like the Philippines, are increasingly forced to make a choice. And therefore, they're transitioning towards what you can call soft balancing, or if not, alignment, right? I mean, is hedging even possible? Now, again, I'll be very quick about this. Sorry for being a little bit too academic about it. So what is hedging? Obviously, hedging is both a conscious and instinctive commitment. It essentially comes from finance, the world of finance, right? You hedge your bets by diversifying your portfolio, putting some of your eggs in this basket, some of your other eggs in that basket. It's an insurance-seeking strategic behavior, right? And it has to be proactive. It cannot be passive. So when you say country is hedging, that means you have a strategic elite that is consciously looking out for opportunities and ways to offset risks by sometimes engaging in seemingly contradictory actions. So best example is Singapore. They sign a defense deal with the Americans. The next thing you know, they also have a memorandum of understanding defense deal with China. But actually, if you pay close attention, they're never exactly symmetrical. But they give this impression of this country trying to keep things on an even keel with two powers, right? So we see the tendency a lot with middle powers and smaller powers in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, not all countries have very, let's say, developed state structures or strategic culture. So sometimes they can come off irrational and incoherent. And sometimes, as in the case of the Philippines, the president himself is incoherent and seemingly irrational. Of course, I'm not talking about the current president, I'm talking about the previous president, who we'll discuss later on. But there has to be a certain structural precondition for hedging to happen. So hedging happens when there's a fear of regional hegemon, there are anxieties over the commitment of the traditional and status quo power, and there is a lack of effective multilateral mechanisms to navigate these tensions in the region. And if you look at Southeast Asia, all of those conditions have been there for quite some time. This is not something new. So what we're talking about here is more risks rather than direct threats. You cannot have hedging when you are about to enter a war and peace situation, right? In short, allies cannot be neutral in moments of war. And in moments of war, countries are forced to choose increasingly. I mean, maintaining neutrality is close to impossible in moments of total war conflagration. Let's look at what happened to Belgium, for instance, during the world wars, and or other kinds of countries who had neutrality positions. So the discussion right now, actually, I'm still debating this with myself among and others, is are countries like the Philippines in a position to still hedge, or are we being forced to align and or at least soft balance? And when you say soft balancing, you're no longer looking at offsetting risks, you're looking already at military countermeasures because there's an existential threat. And that existential threat, or seeming existential threat, is something that we'll discuss in the succeeding slides. Now, speaking of hedging, we see the art of hedging being executed by a lot of our neighbors. So the Vietnamese have their own version of bamboo diplomacy. In fact, Vietnam, for me, was the country of the year last year, because I think they're the only country I know that had a state visit from both Biden and Xi Jinping, almost back to back. I cannot think of any other country who had state visits by the two superpowers in a single year. And the courtship of Vietnam from all quarters is something quite interesting, as I've seen. And as you know, the Vietnamese have a very robust relationship also with the Russians. So just as they're asking for Qualcomm and American companies to come in, as they're talking to BYD, they're also trying to sign multi-billion-dollar arms deal with Russia, right? So this is what they do, multi-alignment, multi-vector approach. Of course, a more interesting case, I would say, is India, right? I think the term they use nowadays is multi-alignment. If I use the term non-alignment with my Indian counterparts, I say, no, we don't do that. That's Nehru. That's Nehruvian. That's Congress Party. We're done with that. We're in multi-alignment. And look at it. One day, Modi is with Putin and schmoozing there. Another day, he's with the Quad countries and Biden and all. And as Jai Shankar, the foreign minister of India, would always put it, you know, we are here for India, right? We're not here to align with any side. So some would say multi-alignment is also a way of, you know, having the cake and eating it too, right? So there's this degree of also strategic opportunism there, as much as there's a degree of hedging. Which brings us to the Philippines and how lucky the Philippines is. So for a very long time in the Philippines, we have had this impression that we're blessed with the best geography, that we're at the intersection of great empires and trading routes and all of that. And we don't share a land border with any country. So unlike Ukraine, right, a lot of people say, oh, Philippines don't want to be Ukraine. Well, except we don't have a land border, especially with a hegemonic power or a former empire. But the reality is that our geography is increasingly becoming a curse and also an impetus for us to step up our game in the 21st century. So, interestingly, empires learn from each other. So one of the things that China is doing right now is trying to affect its own version of Mahanian grand strategy. So, you know, the American naval strategic thinker, Alfred Thayer Mahan, in the late 19th century, who said that, you know, if America wants to be a real power, it has to dominate its adjacent waters. That idea is not new. It came all the way from the Romans, who dominated and turned the Mediterranean into a kind of a Roman lake, right? So the idea is that you cannot be really a real regional power, if you don't dominate your adjacent waters. And if you look at China today, a lot of their defense strategies ironically cite Alfred Thayer Mahan, and they argue that China will not be a real great power if it cannot dominate those immediate waters. Now, each of those body of waters have their own value, both ideational and also material. Ideational because you have Taiwan there, right? And there's no way for China to feel complete, at least this is the rhetoric from the Communist Party in China, if they don't reunify with the so-called renegade province of Taiwan, right? And domination of the South China Sea will be very important with that, not to mention the disputes over Senkaku Diaoyu with Japan in the East China Sea. So that's the first island chain that they want to dominate as their perimeter of defense and also as what they feel is their sphere of influence. But what China is also looking at is dominating the second island chain. This is the Philippine Sea. And the idea there is to push out the Americans from this part of the world, because they see Americans as essentially an external power, as an alien power, right? Although they forget that Guam is actually just there, not too far away from the Philippines. And again, this is also what I call dialectics of empire. So if you look at Russia, they started in what? Moscovy, small, you know, kingdom there. And the next thing you know, they're here in San Francisco. 200 years ago, right? The idea is that the more you expand, the more you need cushion and perimeters of defense, and you can go on and on and on and on about that. So, if you look at the Philippines, we're exactly in the middle of those two, right? We're already facing and confronting China's pushing out and efforts to dominate its adjacent waters in the first island chain, and then also we're increasingly feeling China's growing military presence in the Philippine Sea, as we'll discuss later on. So very quickly, just to help you guys understand, for instance, what's happening just in the first island chain. So on one side, if you look at the Kao Tong shape 9-dash line, which actually used to be 11-dash line, that's what China claims as its own, right? They have different terms for that. They're blue national soil. They claim historic rights in that area because, I don't know, Admiral Zhang He and some of your ancestors thousands of years ago passed through that area. But if you follow modern prevailing international law, it's actually going to be something more like that one, right? If each country just generates 200 nautical miles exclusive economic zone from their coasts, and then you have all of the maritime entitlements accordingly. In fact, the Philippines in 2013 pushed for an arbitration case against China, and legally speaking, the Philippines won this scenario. Except China is a superpower, and just like America or any superpower, superpowers tend to be exceptionalists. They take exception to international law, right? So it's not only the legal claim, it's also how you operationalize your claim. I mean, any major power tends to have revanchist kind of rhetoric and narratives, but it's operationalizing that narrative that is something that we have to pay attention to. So since 2013, China has not only built massive, massive artificial islands, but it has also militarized them. And while it's true that China is not the only country that has militarized these islands, but the scale, the breadth, and the speed of the militarization of those islands is incomparable to any other country. So you look at those giant land features on top, those are the Chinese-made artificial islands and militarized ones. And those on below, the very small ones, are the Vietnamese versions. The ones that the Philippines controls, the one in Tito Island is the second largest naturally formed land feature, but we did not reclaim it. In this way, we did not create, you know, multi-kilometer long airstrips or huge military facilities. And the fear is that eventually what China wants to do is to create an air defense identification zone in that part of the world by creating networks of airstrips and military facilities that can allow China to push anyone out through military force. Now, we're not there yet, but definitely there are increasing discussions about, you know, China trying to affect its own sphere of influence in this part of the world. Which brings me to the other part of this discussion. Again, I know we're in Berkeley, and we can go on and on discussing about American colonial history in the Philippines, all the horrible things that the United States did throughout history. But as far as the Philippines, a lot of countries in the region are concerned, it's not the United States that they see as a primary source of threat, but they see actually China. Now, speaking of the United States, it has a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines and a series of other agreements that bind the Americans to the Filipinos. But the reality is that the parameters of that mutual defense treaty was vague for quite some time. In fact, as I wrote in just a recent piece, A Brief Genealogy of Philippine Claims in the South China Sea, if you look at it, a lot of these features that we control, we have been claiming them since the Spanish era, and we have been claiming them since the Commonwealth era, but the Philippines actually began to operationalize its claim over some of these land features after we gained our independence in the mid-20th century. And initially, the Americans were a little bit wishy-washy about that until the 70s. So what happened in the 70s under a certain person called Ferdinand Marcos Sr., I'm extremely critical of his human rights record, of his democracy record, of his economic management. But when it comes to foreign policy, I think Marcos Sr. was quite a proactive American, Filipino leader. And what he did in the 70s was he tried to operationalize the Philippines' claims by building arguably the first modern airstrip in the Spratlys group of islands, in the Tito Island or Pagasa, which we call today. So suddenly the Americans, particularly under the Nixon administration, and in this case actually Henry Kissinger, was worried that the Filipinos will drag the Americans into war, that the Filipinos will use, as Kissinger put it, the Mutual Defense Treaty as a means for territorial self-aggrandizement. And in a series of cables that were classified more recently, Kissinger essentially said that all we are willing to provide for the Filipinos is diplomatic and political support, but we will not take their claims over those islands and features for granted because they're contested claims. Now, importantly, that gave birth to a policy of strategic ambiguity. And this policy of strategic ambiguity goes essentially from Richard Nixon all the way to President Obama. That is why when Obama visited the Philippines on multiple occasions, especially in 2014, after signing the Enhanced Defense Cooperation with the Philippines, and shortly after making it clear that the U.S. will stand by Japan should there be a war with China over Senkaku de Ayo, he essentially was equivocating on whether Americans will help the Philippines over disputed land features in the area. Things actually just began to change towards the end of the Trump administration, specifically when Secretary Pompeo visited Manila in March of 2019 and openly said any attack on Filipino troops, vessels, on aircrafts in the South China Sea, not just generically in the Pacific, will automatically activate the Mutual Defense Treaty. More interestingly, that year also saw a major incident when a Chinese militia vessel sank a Filipino vessel, fishing vessel, and more than a dozen Filipino almost died. They were only saved thanks to illegal Vietnamese fishermen in the area, right? So thanks to them, these folks were saved. It was kind of an awkward situation. But interestingly, the American ambassador back then, Song Kim, said that even gray zone attacks by China, meaning attacks by Chinese militia, not their conventional forces, could also activate the Mutual Defense Treaty. So the tenor, the operational implication of the Mutual Defense Treaty between the Philippines and the United States has gone through a lot of evolution throughout the past half a century. But in the past 5 years or so, the parameters have become much sharper and clearer than ever, and that's precisely why the stakes for the United States are extremely high here. This is not just a fight over, as Obama put it, a bunch of rocks. No, this is a matter of ideational and material interest for China. Material because the South China Sea is one of the most fisheries-rich and diverse places on Earth, and there could be trillions of dollars of energy resources also in that area, right? So a lot is at stake here, and this sets the tone for our conversation today. So that's a long introduction, apologies for that. But the discussion today is, what's up with Marcos, right? What's Marcos Jr. up to, right? Now, there's a lot of problematic discourse out there because on one hand, the liberal critics of Marcos always thought that he is, he's essentially another Manchurian candidate, right? Similar to Duterte. And in fact, during the election period, what happened with, as you can see, I deliberately skipped Duterte because that would be 1 hour of conversation, but we can go back to that. Essentially, what happened with President Duterte is that once he came into power, he made it very clear that he doesn't want territorial disputes with China to be the defining dimension of bilateral relationship, and he was extremely critical of the United States and the Philippines' dependence on the West, and things really went haywire over the years, and we can have a long conversation about that. So when Marcos Jr. ran for presidency in 2022, he was part of a coalition with the offspring, daughter of Duterte, the so-called UNITIM, and during multiple speeches and interventions, he made it very clear that he agrees with Duterte's diplomacy-first approach, and that what he wants is, you know, pursue a new era of golden relationship with China, which is exactly what he did. In fact, after Marcos Jr. won the presidency, one of the first things he did was to call President Xi Jinping, and he openly said, you know, we want to shift our bilateral relationship to new heights. And he also met top leaders from China, including Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and said, we want to have a new golden era of bilateral relationship. So that's why suddenly there are now all sorts of conspiracy theories that what happened? Why is Marcos suddenly not nice to China, right? Was he bought off by the Americans? That's one rhetoric, right? The other one was maybe, you know, he was just, you know, trying to dissimulate during the election period and the real Marcos is coming out. The other one is, oh, these Filipinos, once again, they're making trouble and they're the agent provocateurs in this part of the world and dragging the Americans in. So I call that strategic gaslighting, right? It's a very important thing to keep in mind. So what exactly did happen under Marcos Jr.? So there are actually four factors to keep in mind. And I'll go quickly through this and we can have a discussion over that. The thing is this. Marcoses are OG, right? They're the original gangster, right? The problem with Duterte was that, you know, he was a parvenu, right? He came from the South. He didn't have much experience with international geopolitics. And to be honest, he was taken for a ride by China. In fact, what happened during Duterte's period is what I call pledge trap. Everyone talks about debt trap. What happened there was pledge trap. China made billions of dollars of pledges, but not really much came in. And yet, in exchange for those pledges, Duterte forward deployed all sorts of geopolitical concessions. He tried to downgrade relations with America. He canceled plans for joint patrols. He did not assert arbitration award in 2016. So you had a weird situation during Duterte when essentially the argument would be, it is our right not to assert our sovereign right. Because there were some awkward meetings, I remember, in the ASEAN summit in 2017 when the United States, Australia, and Japan issued a trilateral statement calling on China to abide by the arbitration award of 2016, which nullified China's claim and validated Philippines' maritime claims in the area. And back then, the Philippine Foreign Secretary, Cayetano, essentially came out, it's like, it's none of your business if we don't assert our rights. Like, that's our prerogative, right? So you had an awkward situation like that. And in fact, the Philippines, when it was the ASEAN chairman in 2017, tried to downplay the disputes in the South China Sea. But the thing is, the Marcoses are different. They never needed China in the way that Duterte needed China. When he ran for president in 2016, we can have a long conversation about that, on the record and off the record. And Marcos Jr.'s victory in the 2022 elections was just so overwhelming, close to 60% of the votes, that he always had more room for maneuver, right? And in many ways, also, as we discussed in factor number two, one of the things that that made Marcos much more open to the West was how the Biden administration reached out to him very proactively. My understanding is that when Marcos was running for presidency, his worry was that a democratic administration in America will be a little bit lukewarm to him, to put it mildly. And of course, we have many folks from the Philippine opposition who questioned the result of the elections and said it was a fraudulent elections. But the thing is, it was quite telling that during his first press conference as president-elect, what Marcos said was, Biden was the first foreign leader to call me. And within weeks, you had Wendy Sherman, back then the number two at the State Department, visiting Manila and telling Marcos and the public that he will enjoy sovereign immunity. As you know, the Marcoses are facing many court cases in the United States for corruption and human rights violation during their era. So that reassurance game, that charm offensive by the United States, I think was very important. But nevertheless, Marcos was still giving a chance to his relationship to China. And in fact, what Marcos did was, within a few months into office, he told China that, hey, maybe you want to act on your investment pledges. In fact, there were some discussions in August and September of 2022 when the Philippines was pressuring China to enforce some of the projects that were unfulfilled. So China has a number of multi-billion dollar supposed projects in the Philippines, but the funding was not coming in. There were a lot of delays. So what Marcos was expecting was to get concrete and tangible outcomes from his first major overseas visit, which was to China. So just like Duterte, his first overseas state visit was not to White House, was not to Japan, it was actually to Beijing. The problem was that trip turned out as extremely fruitless. He effectively got nothing. He only had around just 2 days there. He brought hundreds of businessmen there. But if you look at the, 15, 16, 17 points that came out of that that bilateral meeting with the Chinese leadership, particularly Xi Jinping, there was no tangible outcomes for the Philippines. And one of the things that really worried Marcos Jr. was that China offered also no concessions in the South China Sea. And one of the problems we have in the Philippines right now is that we're facing an energy crisis because the leading source of our natural gas in Malampay is running out. We want to develop an alternative source. It's in Ritbank, close to Spratlys, but the Chinese are harassing us and not allowing us to develop their sources there. So Marcos Jr. reportedly was expecting to get some sort of concession from China on that front, but China gave him nothing. And my sense is precisely that China was also not sure about Marcos Jr., so they were also holding back. This is something we can also discuss later on, because one of the things I noticed with China is that they're not very sophisticated when they deal with a lot of regional states. We always talk about China as a sophisticated statecraft. They plan for the next 1,000 years. But the reality is that I think they got the Philippines wrong on multiple occasions. They thought they could get the Philippines on the cheap during Duterte, and then with Marcos, they didn't offer him anything. And that combined with Americans coming in and trying to charm him and bring him to his side, I think really did the magic. Now, the third factor, and this is a very important factor that I discussed in my piece for Journal of Democracy, among others, is there was also a fallout simultaneously with the Dutertes. As you know, Duterte is no longer the president of the Philippines, but the vice president is Duterte. And former president Rodrigo Duterte is also very vocal in his criticism of the direction of Marcos Jr.'s foreign policy. So you also have this domestic dynamic, and not to exaggerate it, I would say sometimes the Philippines feels like, Berlin or Austria at the beginning of Cold War, right? Whereby we're at the middle of these proxy wars, whereby pro-American and pro-China factions are duking it out. And the greatest manifestation of that is essentially the House of Marcos and House of Duterte. It's as explicit as it can get. Out of 10, 15 years of writing about the Philippines as a journalist and as an academic, this is the first time I see those fault lines coming out, those geopolitical fault lines coming out, and essentially dominating even domestic political discussions. Now, if you want to know about the drama, it's a long conversation. You can check some of the pieces that I cited there. But I would say the fourth factor is ASEAN inaction. Remember I said hedging works, right? If to a certain degree, multilateral mechanisms are ineffective, but they're just effective enough for you to have a hope that things will not descend into a zero-sum game among the superpowers. But the problem we have right now in Southeast Asia is that not only are ASEAN countries not helping us, but we have some of ASEAN leaders, I think you know some of these people, came over during the APEC summit. Some of them are openly, saying, oh, we're not the Philippines. And they're actually blaming us for actually creating tensions in the region. And even, some of the leaders I expected more from, Lee Hsien Loong of Singapore, for instance, in the New Economy Forum with Bloomberg last year, he said something like, essentially his message was, hey, Filipinos, maybe you want to, be careful what you wish for, essentially. That's the kind of rhetoric we're getting from some of our neighboring countries, not to mention some of the more China-dependent countries in Indochina who don't want to do anything about the South China Sea. So when you see a combination of all of these four factors, it's quite understandable that Marcos Jr. moved towards a strategic reset, essentially in the second 6 months of his first year in office. So by February and March of last year, Marcos Jr., there was a market change in his rhetoric. In fact, you can detect the market change in his rhetoric during the World Economic Forum, just weeks after he visited China, where he said, one of the things that keeps him awake at night is the South China Sea dispute. Mm-hmm. which is day and night different from his rhetoric just a year or months earlier, when he was saying, no, our relationship with China is multidimensional. This is just one of the issues. Essentially, we can split the difference. We can compartment. Now, suddenly, his tone is changing. And within weeks, things got even more interesting because he openly discussed a trilateral security framework with Japan and the United States, which is very poignant as we speak, because that summit is now happening in the White House. And then more importantly, he decided not only to continue the defense agreement signed by his liberal predecessor, Benigno Aquino, the bétonnoir of the Marcoses, but he even expanded that defense agreement, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. As you know, Americans can no longer have permanent bases in the Philippines. That's unconstitutional. But they can have rotational access to Philippine bases. It's kind of a workaround. Now, but for me, it's not only the implementation and continuation of the defense deal under Aquino, signed under Aquino, which was semi-frustrated under Duterte, but it's the location of the new bases under ETCA. And a lot of these new bases are actually towards the north of the Philippines, which brings us to the conversation over Taiwan, which I'll discuss to you guys shortly. And then that year also saw massive, massive exercises between the Philippines and US, with Australia, Japan, even UK also sending representatives. That was the largest ever, I think 18,000 troops and participants. So I'm just showing to you guys chronologically the evolution of Marcos Jr.'s foreign policy so that you can see actually there's a logic, there's a method to that shift. There are factors that are shaping that. And obviously, things are really reaching a boiling point right now because, honestly, one of the debates we're having right now is what's really going on? Because for a long time, China has been engaging in what you call gray zone strategy, meaning they leverage their maritime naval dominance, but they never, you know, fire a shot or cannons, right? So what they do is they deploy massive militia. They put gigantic Coast Guard vessels there. But one of the things that happened over the past few months is that there were multiple occasions when China used water cannons, and these water cannons are getting more and more powerful. The pressure is getting more and more powerful. And actually, a number of our naval officers were injured during some of these recent incidents. So the debate we're having right now is that, is this still gray zone, or is this veering towards lethal force? And therefore, what is the implication for the Mutual Defense Treaty between the United States and the Philippines? And as we understand, Biden is about to publicly call on Xi Jinping and China not to use aggressive water cannon tactics that could be actually lethal and therefore effectuate or operationalize the Mutual Defense Treaty. Now, one of the things I want to quickly discuss is, I want to also push back against this rhetoric of, you know, the Philippines as being the kind of a small power there. The reality is that this is not the Philippines of 1970s or 2000. This is a Philippines that has a $500 billion economy. It's one of the fastest growing economy. It's about to invest $36 billion in its defense over the next 10 years. It's signing massive agreements. I visited some of our new warships. A lot of that we're buying from South Korea. We're looking at buying submarines. So this is not the same Philippines that we have known for quite some time. It's a country that has more and more resources. It's the fastest growing country in Southeast Asia, even faster than Vietnam. So we're finally having those kinds of resources. And while China is a very powerful country, as you can see, this is the low index showing power dynamics in Asia. It's true that US and China are so powerful, but a lot of other countries are moving up and catching up. And we can have a discussion about that, because if a lot of these middle-sized countries team up together, they can actually quite match China, right? We can have a long debate about methodology, but the reality is that while it's an asymmetrical relationship between China and a lot of its neighbors, if its neighbors work it together, if its neighbors continue to grow as fast as they do and build their basic defense capabilities, then you will have not totally symmetrical, but much more interesting equilateral dynamic pluralistic order in that part of the world. Now, I mentioned a while ago the Taiwan aspect. So the reason why the ETCA decision was important is because we were wondering why are some of these bases under the ETCA with the United States, new bases in the north of the country, right? There are essentially two ways of looking at it. One is the Philippines is becoming an integral part of a proactive deterrence strategy over Taiwan, right? So I don't buy this argument that by 2027, China is going to invade Taiwan. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. We can have a long conversation about how the Ukraine war is affecting the strategic calculus in Beijing. As you know, an amphibious attack is way more complicated logistically than a land-based attack. We can have a long conversation about that. But the thing is, the threat to Taiwan is real and present. And Taiwan is also an extremely important country. So if you look at the ongoing global chip wars, I mean, the TSMC of Taiwan alone, right, produces the majority of the high-end semiconductors. In fact, more than 90% of the most high-end semiconductors in the world are made in Taiwan alone. So the stakes in Taiwan are extremely high. It's not only about shared values, it's not only about the history of Japan and Taiwan, history of US and Taiwan, it's also about the fact that Taiwan, if oil was the engine of global capitalism in the 20th century, the semiconductors are kind of like that. Except oil was produced in 12, 14 different countries, while the most high-end semiconductors are all produced in that tiny island, right? And that's how important Taiwan is. Now, why is the Philippines important? Why the Philippine-Japan-US Trilateral Alliance, or what they call JAFUS? Geography is a huge part of that. In academic world, in policy world, we put the Philippines in the Southeast Asia region, but the reality is that the Philippines is much closer to Taiwan. Like, Manila to Taiwan is just 1 hour flight. Kaohsiung to some of the northern cities in the Philippines is just over 30 minutes. I come from the north, so when we swim in the north, in Pagutput area, literally on radio, you can hear Taiwanese radio, right? We're extremely close to them. And the same thing with Japan. A lot of their military bases, which they're fortifying right now, are just as close to the northern shores of Taiwan as the Philippine bases in our super north are close to Taiwan's southern shores. In fact, the Philippines geography is even more important. Why? Because a lot of the simulations done when it comes to a potential invasion of Taiwan show that most likely invasion of Taiwan will happen from the southwestern region because of topography. As you know, Taiwan is very mountainous. So the Philippines will be very much at the front line of that. Now, obviously we're talking about the war scenario, but in global strategy, it's not what happens during war per se, it's how to prevent that war through proactive deterrence. So what's happening right now is the Philippines and Japan are essentially teaming up together with the United States to proactively deter, right, a potential invasion of Taiwan. Although, again, I have my doubts about all of those timelines that are being heard there. This is really a deterrence game out there. But in the Philippines, there's a new debate coming out. And the new debate is this. Some of the strategists in the Philippines say, actually, Taiwan is more important to us than the South China Sea. Because in the South China Sea, we're fighting over small islands and land features, right? From a strategic and military standpoint, a bigger nightmare for the Philippines is if China becomes our neighbor from a giant island of Taiwan, right? That will immediately put us within the range of danger. And therefore, their argument is it's not so much the Philippines helping the US and Japan to protect Taiwan, it's about also Philippines protecting its own interests. Because what the Philippines is also doing right now is giving Americans more and more basing access so that in exchange, it will also improve its ability to have surveillance, ISR, and defensive positioning in its northern regions and towards the Philippine Sea. So there's an ongoing debate there. And speaking of debate, there's also domestic pushback. So some of governors in the Philippines, like Governor Mamba, for instance, in Cagayan, are openly critical of this. In fact, the very sister of the president, let's just call it sibling geopolitics, is openly against this direction of the Philippine foreign policy under her own brother, younger brother. And on multiple occasions, she came out and essentially opposed any kind of major exercises between the United States and the Philippines in the northern regions of the country. And I think this debate will be even more intensified in the coming months as the prospect of Japanese rotational military access to Philippine bases also gains ground. So as you know, in the coming hours and days, Japan and the Philippines are expected to sign a reciprocal access agreement, which allows for more bilateral military drills and exchange of defense equipment. But some are suspecting that Japan wants to also push for its own version of ETCA or mini ETCA in the Philippines. So a lot of things are moving on right now. So this raises a number of questions. And that's why, as you notice, I'm trying to avoid over-explaining some of the parts because we can go on forever for that. But I want to leave that for discussion. The dilemma for the Philippines essentially is this. This is the debate. Is our security cooperation with the United States really about deterrence of China, helping us in the South China Sea, avoiding a war on Taiwan, avoiding occupation of Taiwan by China? Or is this just going to increase the Philippine dependence on the United States? This is a debate out there. You can guess where I am on this side of the debate, but I'm willing to listen to both sides of this. And it's a very intense debate we're having now in the Philippines. The other one is, what will China do? Because my suspicion is China will not just sit idly by. And of all the three countries I mentioned, Japan, Philippines, and US, I think the Philippines is clearly the most vulnerable one. And it is hard not to think that the way China is treating us in the South China Sea, this semi-lethal water cannoning, is their way of saying, be careful what you're doing in the north, especially vis-a-vis Taiwan. So my suggestion always was, maybe we can work it the other way and say, we can calibrate the amount of security cooperation we'll have with the US in exchange for China not harassing us in the South China Sea. But then again, there are other people who are going to debate that, no, that's a wrong way of looking at it, because Taiwan is the most important part for the Philippines, because we don't want China to be our neighbor to the north. So these are the kinds of debates that are ongoing in the Philippines. The other debate that is also ongoing in the Philippines is, why are we doing this? Why are we even aligned with the United States? Why can't we just hedge and do the multi-alignment game that the Vietnams and Indias of this world are doing? Because I forgot to mention it, Vietnam and India also have territorial disputes with China. In the case of Vietnam, of course, the maritime disputes, and in the case of course, India is the disputes in the Himalayan region. So some are saying, why can't we do it like them? Again, that's a long conversation we can have later on. And then, as I said, theoretically and geopolitically, I mean, or rather operationally, can the Philippines continue to just hedge? Or the Philippines will eventually be forced to fully align with the United States and Japan in this picture? Because the whole sensibility that I was trying to communicate in this mini lecture was that a lot of the things Philippines is doing is not because we're being told by the Americans to do it. It's more of about China is forcing our hand. So we're in this really difficult strategic predicament right now. And every move we make is going to have a lot of risks for the country as much as opportunities. And lastly, as I said, there's a lot of strategic gaslighting going on there. This idea of essentially it's Philippine exceptionalism, that the Philippines is an outlier in ASEAN. We're the only one who has a bad relationship with China. We're the one dragging in the Americans, and we're the troublemakers. And as I said, I have a big problem with that kind of discourse. This one, I'm very squarely on the other side of the debate. My argument is that the Philippines would have loved to have a pragmatic and fruitful relationship with China, except we're not getting that. We didn't get it under Duterte. Marcos tried it, it's not working. And there's just no way for any Filipino president to just sit idly by while all of these things are happening in the South China Sea, not to mention the threat in Taiwan. Because one thing I didn't mention a while ago is that all authoritative surveys in the Philippines show that 80 to 90% of Filipinos want the government to take a more assertive stance against China. And 70 to 80% of Filipinos want the country to team up with the United States and other countries to better protect its sovereign rights. So as Marcos Jr. correctly pointed out, this is not about his personal preference, this is about his mandate. This is about what the Filipino people want him to do, which in retrospect makes Rodrigo Duterte a very curious case that we can discuss more later on. Anyway, this was not a lecture to make you experts on these issues. We can go on and on about it. But what I tried to do over the past 30 minutes or so was to just pass on the sensibility and the dilemmas and predicaments and the ongoing debates in the region, in the Philippines and beyond, and how countries like the Philippines are really squeezed in between the superpowers. On that note, thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions and comments.
I'd like to request Professor Agarwal to start the conversation. Maybe Richard, you can sit down first here.
Sure, yeah, please. Yeah, yeah.
So we have 30 minutes, and I'll give the first 15 minutes, I guess, to Professor Agarwal, and then maybe Vinny, you can just open it up.
Yeah, no,
it.
Yeah. I think it's more fun. Well, thank you very much. I must say that was the most comprehensive talk I've heard in a long time, covering all aspects of international relations, risk management, hedging, balancing, and so on, so pretty thorough. But I have a few questions that we might be thinking about that you addressed a little bit. So let me begin with the role of ASEAN. You know, you said is the Philippines an outlier, and ASEAN has trouble having national kind of unity among itself. The ASEAN countries are often at loggerheads, particularly over countries like Myanmar, you know, which military dictatorship and so on. Do you think ASEAN has a role to play here in countering China in some way, given that many of the ASEAN members themselves have differing foreign policies, like Vietnam, which is much friendlier with China than the Philippines is currently, at least? So is there a role for, because after all, ASEAN was created in 1967 with the goal of trying to counter communism, and now it's a kind of a different communism. It's not the communism of the, you know, North Korea or North Vietnam. It's the communism of China, but in this case, it's more than communism. It's really superpower politics. So does ASEAN have a role here?
Absolutely, ASEAN has a role here. I mean, for me, I think I'm one of the last few ASEAN aficionados in the Philippines, because to be honest, whenever I'm in a meeting with other Philippine experts, the terms I use, I hear is ASEAN is useless, ASEAN is an enabler of China, ASEAN is an apologist of China. In fact, some of the leaders in the region are openly coming out and saying, oh, don't demonize China, they seem to be lawyering for China. But if you look at the history of ASEAN, it is not true that ASEAN is non-intervention. It's just not true. We know during the Cold War period, when it was a much more tight-knit group of similar-minded leaders, unfortunately back then dictatorial leaders, they actually were very aggressively intervening in regional affairs, including what was happening in Cambodia. We know that for a long time, ASEAN leaders actually supported the Pol Pot regime in the United Nations when Vietnam invaded and occupied Cambodia. And then later on, there was a moment of redemption when they pressured Hun Sen and some of the domestic factions in Cambodia to move towards pluralistic politics as an unsaid precondition for joining ASEAN. That's why when the leader of the opposition of Cambodia, when they go to Indonesia, they always say, thank you for the contribution you made in the 1990s to push us towards more pluralistic politics. We hope you do the same, right? If you look at ASEAN also, we have a long history of essentially doing it the Frank Sinatra way. If we cannot agree 100%, we cannot have a consensus, then we can do it minilaterally, right? In an ad hoc, flexible way, which doesn't require unanimity. And I think the most constructive example is during the East Timor situation. As you know, obviously, East Timor is a sensitive issue to Indonesia. You couldn't expect the maximally positive contribution by Indonesia at some point because of the history, the bitterness. So what happened was Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, they directly contributed to peacekeeping operations and institution building that helped East Timor to successfully transition to a more or less robust democracy towards the end of 1990s. In the early 2000s. So there are many examples where actually ASEAN countries came together, intervened in regional affairs, but in a constructive manner. I would also add the Philippines' decision to take China to international court. That was not supported by any country, at least officially, as far as I know. But in the end, after the Philippines' unilateral decision, because this was not done in consultation, because no one was going to support it, at least publicly, with the slight exception of Vietnam, which we can have a discussion about, but in the end, when we won the arbitration case, guess what? All of our neighbors are using it for protecting their own interests. So the Malaysians, for instance, in 2019, pushed for formalization of their extended continental shelf claim in certain parts of the South China Sea, and they invoked the Philippine Arbitration Award. And when there was a little bit pushback from China during the Mahathir era, their foreign minister openly said, now, we have an option of also taking it to international court. The Indonesian, which are not directly involved in the South China Sea dispute, but are now involved because the tip of China's nine dash line is so vague, it's overlapping with their North Natuna Sea, they are also invoking on clause and arbitration case. And obviously Vietnam, which is the most important case. So if you look at Vietnam, my understanding is they led us on a little bit because honestly, when we filed our arbitration case in 2013, for the next 2 to 3 years, we kept on going to Vietnam, right? Getting invitation to talk about South China Sea. And I think some of us got an impression that Vietnam might join us and or file a parallel case, technically speaking. They never did that. But the Vietnamese essentially took the outcome, supported it more or less diplomatically and officially. And they also tend to always invoke that arbitration case to threaten China whenever China pushes the envelope a bit too much. So in short, our decision not to consult ASEAN and to do what we felt was the right thing ended up being the right thing also for the rest of ASEAN, giving leverage to Vietnam, Malaysia, and Indonesia in ways that they would not have had otherwise, right? So that's why it's a complicated picture. And then the other thing about ASEAN is that the ASEAN of nowadays is very different from ASEAN of the Cold War era or even ASEAN of 2010s. So I'll give you an example. In early 2010s, when Indonesia was the ASEAN chairman, Thailand and Cambodia almost came to blows over that holy temple on their border. And Indonesia stepped in and encouraged the two countries to take their case to International Court of Justice, if I'm not mistaken, and eventually it was resolved. So again, you could say that's a form of intervention or shuttle diplomacy. And in 2012, when Cambodia under Hun Sen tried to block any discussion of the South China Sea, this is shortly after the Scarborough Shoal crisis, again, Marty Netaragawa, the great foreign minister of Indonesia, went across the region and made sure that under the next chairman, which was Brunei, this will not happen again. That we will never give a prerogative to the country to block a regional issue from being even discussed. Because that created very, very ugly exchanges between the late President Aquino and Hun Sen. If you were there in the November summit in 2012, they were going at it. It was really, really bad. And there were some people in the Philippines even saying, we have to pull out from ASEAN. This is a useless organization. So what I'm saying is, it's not true that ASEAN always operates on consensus. The problem is that nowadays, our understanding of consensus is unanimity. And ipso facto, it's impossible to get unanimity on any sensitive issue, whether it's Myanmar or it's South China Sea, because of the extreme diversity of the 10 member states. That's why we know behind the scenes, people like Lee Kuan Yew, this is in WikiLeaks, right? I wrote something about that. Said that the moment we accepted the Cambodians into the regional organization, you know, we pushed ourselves back for 20 years, right? Kosikan Bilahari, the great Singaporean diplomat, the other year, he got into trouble with Cambodia by openly saying maybe we should expel these guys, right? Thankfully, that worked because Cambodia behaved itself. I mean, I don't mean it in a patronizing way. I mean it on the South China Sea issue. They didn't do anything crazy on the South China Sea issue. But that's the thing. Unlike the European Union, there's no Copenhagen criteria. You know, the idea of being a member of Southeast Asia is just geographic, cultural, and to a certain degree, psychological. So when you have an extremely diverse organization of 10 members with very different threat perceptions, very different webs of interdependence with China, right? I mean, if you're Laos or Cambodia, you are so dependent on China in ways the Philippines is not, right?
So let me take that question up. So, I mean, you've given me some examples, given us examples where ASEAN was able to intervene. Intervening in domestic affairs and dealing with Thailand disputes is very different than creating a counter-alliance against China. ASEAN working together, given that in many ways Cambodia and Laos are in the pockets of the Chinese, right? So in that sense, even though I'm a big ASEAN fan too, I don't see what ASEAN can do from a military perspective or a joint perspective. And you've given a few examples. Okay, they're using the Philippines case, but the Philippines shot itself in the foot with Duterte by not even promoting the case. So Philippines have lost a lot of credibility in my view as well, right? So the question is it really possible for ASEAN to do some of the things maybe the Americans or someone else would like to do, which is actually serve as a counterweight to China? I don't see it.
So there are three levels to that. So one level is you have certain member states which see the Philippines as the ocean provocateur and America as a kind of a meddling external power, and they essentially buy the Chinese narrative on this. We know which countries these are. I don't want to get into diplomatic trouble. And then you have this perspective, because I gave a talk in ASEAN Summit last year. We had interesting discussion. The other perspective is this, and I think some of our Indonesian friends tend to be very much invested in this argument. The idea is this. ASEAN is just too weak at this point in time to stand up to China. And at the same time, we're doing good economically. So just give us 10 to 15 years. We're growing faster from China. And then by 2030, 2035, we're going to sit down with China on a much better terms of engagement, right? So let's just do nothing crazy now. Focus on economic growth. And it's not a totally crazy argument, because for the first time in 30 years, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines are all growing faster than China. Indonesia is already going to be a multi-trillion dollar economy. Philippines and Vietnam. So the idea is, you know, bide your time. Essentially, let's be the Deng Xiaopings, right? You know, hide your claws or whatever little claws you have. Bide your time. And in 10 to 15 years, we'll be strong enough to deal with China in better terms. Then comes the third group. The third group is, that's great, except anything could happen in the next days and months. Forget about the next 10 years. How sure are you that we can keep things on an even keel for the next 10 to 15 years? I mean, I just talked about the second Thomas Scholl situation, which is extremely explosive. And that third school of thought is for minilateral cooperation within ASEAN. So the most natural one looks like the Philippines and Vietnam. Now, obviously, we can have a long conversation about Vietnam because Vietnam is also going through its own political transition in nowadays. They're essentially purging all the liberals and the reformist figures. I mean, liberals with Vietnam standards, and the more KGB-style guys are taking over, who are actually even more paranoid about Western influence in their country. But nevertheless, when Marcos visited Vietnam earlier this year, he got a very good reception, and both sides agreed to a series of maritime agreements, including potentially maritime security agreements, whereby at least there's a certain degree of security cooperation there. Now, no one is under any illusion that Vietnam and Philippines alone can hold China to account. But if these two or three countries, let's say maybe Indonesia under more assertive Prabowo, that's still up in the air because Prabowo could be also like a Duterte, Toscan. But if they work with the Quad, they work with other trilaterals like AUKUS, then they can collectively have a different kind of counterbalancing effect. So that's the third school of thought. So there are multiple layers here, and I think the problem with ASEAN is that we tend to hear just one school of thought, when in fact there are multiple schools of thought simultaneously duking it out.
So maybe you could say something about Philippine domestic politics, on which I'm not an expert, but it seems that you have Sara Duterte, you know, sister, and then there's some controversy, and they say they get along, but on the other hand, she's being criticized by her own brother. So is it a sustainable domestic coalition to pursue a strategy of, you know, engagement with the United States and countering China, which is what you're advocating, which I'm actually for, so I'm not going to criticize that strategy, but is it domestically, politically feasible, given that you have this weird vice president from the previous administration, and then you have Marcos,
yeah,
who has his own, as you noted, history of old gangsters in some sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty weird coalition if you think about it.
Well, I mean, people are free to listen to our podcast series because we discuss this every day. No, but kidding aside, so the thing is, for a time, Sara Duterte, the daughter of the former president, tried to have her own version of multi-alignment, right? Which is have the cake and eat it too. Be part of the Marcos administration, but I'm still the daughter of my father, the sister of my brother, and everyone is bashing the president. But I think things are going to get more and more tricky as we move forward, because as the tensions get more fierce, essentially there's a loyalty call nowadays. So one of the biggest stories in the Philippines right now is Sara Duterte, the vice president who has everything to say about the Gaza conflict, Afghan refugees, name you, has zero comment on the South China Sea disputes. And the only time that we saw her making any statement vis-a-vis China was when she greeted China on the anniversary of the PLA in some sort of, I don't know, half-massacred Mandarin or something like that, right? I mean, you can ask my Mandarin-speaking friends how good her Chinese was. So actually, the meme nowadays is, what is Sara Duterte's comment? And then they get clip of her Mandarin statement. So I think it's becoming more and more difficult for Sara Duterte, right, to be that kind of a multi-aligned figure. And I think she's being more pulled and pulled to the side of her father. And as I understand, the father is seeking to visit China again as a kind of a special friend of China. In fact, last year, he went to China back-to-back with Henry Kissinger, right? And now this month, he's hoping to go back to China. And they're just, you know, unabashed about it. Their idea is U.S. is the empire. And interestingly, a lot of leftist nationalist groups are kind of on the same side as the Dutertes, when in fact they were kind of enemies. Yeah. So suddenly you have all of this strange bedfellows and realignments happening in the Philippines right now. But the center of gravity is clear. 80 to 90% of Filipinos are critical of China and want us to have a stronger ties with the United States and Japan.